the House of Comments. I'm Mark Thompson. We're on a little bit of a break at the moment from the regular episodes, but we did promise that we would try and get some special episodes with interviews with people and so forth. And recently I interviewed Paul Evans about his book, Save Democracy, Abolish Voting. By day, Paul is a trade union official working in the entertainment industry, but he's also a long-standing political blogger, having spent years working on digital democracy projects. And this is his first book, which is published by the Democratic Society. I first met Paul in the run-up to the 2010 general election at a political event that included Jeremy Hunt and Tom Watson. I remember I had a good chat with him for about half an hour afterwards, and he certainly stuck in my mind. And I remember making a mental note at the time that he was someone I should keep in touch with, and I have done over the years. I very much hope you enjoy the interview. So I'm delighted today to be joined by Paul Evans, who long-term listeners of the podcast will remember Paul. He's been on a couple of times, and each time Paul's been on, we've ended up discussing to varying degrees the merits and demerits of referendums. And Paul has written a book, which was published recently, called Save Democracy, Abolish Voting. And Paul is joining me today to talk about this. So good evening, Paul.
Good evening, Mark. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, indeed. It's good to have you back. So it's a bit of a kind of provocative, clickbaity title, or at least it seems to me. I'm sure that's not an accident. Do you want to just give us a brief synopsis from your perspective about the book, why you decided to write it, and kind of what it's about and what its conclusions are?
Sure. Yeah, I think the clickbaity title is what wasn't quite as in you know, I was in two minds about it because, you know, all my life I've listened to people who say, oh, we don't live in a democracy. This isn't a democracy. And basically what they're kind of saying is that a democracy is a system of government that often listens uniquely to them. I'm actually a massive fan of representative democracy. I think it's been responsible for it really, you know, history's most extraordinarily successful period. You know, it's resulted in more progress, more, you know, a greater level of peace, injustices of you know, withered and fallen under the tread of representative democracy. So I'm very keen on it. And I think what I'm really saying here is that representative democracy for almost all of, you know, recent modern history has been the best form of democracy we could have. But I'm beginning to think that day is over. And actually, there may be better things. I think that representative democracy is beginning to face a bit of a perfect storm with lots of little things that are a threat to it. But ultimately, the possibility and the real possibility of an interactive, participative government and the demand for it as, you know, is responsible for a lot of those little cuts that are threatening to destroy democracy.
So you mentioned about engagement and kind of online engagement and that sort of thing. And you talk about that in the book. Now, when I've heard this sort of argument previously, I've heard people say things like everyone should be allowed to vote on every issue. We don't need Parliament anymore. People can just vote on the issues themselves and they can just log on to a secure website and click a button and they can decide what they want. And therefore, the population will get what they want in a more direct way. I mean, having talked to you on previous occasions and having read the book, I don't think that's what you're advocating. But do you want to kind of explain why that's not what you're advocating?
Sure. I do think there's a problem with voters voting. I think that, you know, we have a problem with rational ignorance. Rational ignorance is really the fuel that's made representative democracy work in lots of ways. The fact that on most subjects, most people are relatively agnostic and they delegate their decision to somebody who they can punish if they get it wrong and they can re-elect if on balance they get it right. I don't think most people are qualified to deal with most of the complex issues that concern them. It's not that they're, I mean, people often portray this as an elitist position that I'm saying that people are stupid. I don't think people are stupid. I think that some of the most intelligent people I've ever met are really not qualified to participate in big decisions for a variety of reasons. It's not because they don't have the intelligence. It's because they have other things that they focus on. I mean, you know, we're all familiar with people who have got a great reputation as a scientist who suddenly step outside of their field of expertise and make themselves look a bit daft. And I think that, you know, most people, I don't believe that, I mean, this is one of the most shocking things over the last couple of years, I don't believe that quite a lot of people who work as members of parliament are be able to write a, you know, reasonable standard essay on Burke's ideas of representative democracy. I've certainly heard politicians who've been around for decades say, well, you know, we think this Brexit is a dreadful idea and it's going to absolutely wreck the country. But, you know, people seem to want it. So I'm going to vote to sign Article 50, as Margaret Beckett did. You know, she's been in Parliament for more than four decades. And to say that would suggest that she wouldn't get a very good mark in an A-level essay on representative democracy. So I think that there is a real problem with people's ability to devote the right amount of time and the right amount of expertise to deliberate on complex issues on their own behalf. And actually, good decisions are made in a distributed way rather than made by single individuals. It's very rare that a single individual will come up with a better idea than, you know, a large group of people who are, you know, procrastinating on a problem.
It's the wisdom of crowds sort of theory that you're referring to there, is it?
Up to a point, yeah. I mean, the wisdom of crowds is a nice, easy to understand, you know, thing. But I mean, really, this is Hayek. This is, you know, you may find it odd to find a lefty like me talking about Hayek, but it's the sort of thing that Hayek would have argued. And I think it's right. I think that, you know, I do take the liberal part of liberal democracy seriously. And I think liberalism is a very good engine to drive democracy. And so distributed wisdom is an important part of liberalism, I think.
OK, so if you're going to take away the vote as the mechanism by which people, voters, as we currently call them, might have to start calling them something else.
Citizens.
Citizens.
Many of whom aren't voters, by the way.
True. Yes. Yeah, good point. So what are you going to replace that mechanism with? What are you advocating?
Okay. Well, this is the bit where, you know, and you'll see that everyone who's reviewed the book has said, look, you know, I understand that this book has been written with a bit of irony. But the proposal that the book has is that if people have an equal share of ownership over the policy making, the microeconomy that makes policy, that would then give us something that ensures that democracy reflects everybody's opinions, not just the people who've got an opinion today or got a ready opinion or people who can be bothered to vote or people who have the time to think about things. It means that literally everybody is represented and represented equally. You know, you have a democracy there where everybody's interests are both defended and advanced fairly if people had an equal share over the ownership of government. So the government and the book describes a mechanism by which we could all have an equal ownership over the over that microeconomy that runs policymaking. And that includes journalism, electoral politics, political parties, the sort of policymaking end of the civil service, think tanks, pressure groups, NGOs, all of that sort of thing. The idea of nationalizing that as a microeconomy, perhaps, maybe nationalizing as a word that is not the word I'd choose because it puts a certain sector of the population off, but certainly socializing, putting that in equal control is what the book advocates. I don't see a political path to get us from between here and there. But the book's intended to get people to think, you know, to think through that and possibly generate a few policy ideas that could come from that.
Yeah, no, I could see the way you've written the book is very much here are some ideas. You even admit in the book that, you know, they're probably not all fully thought through and stress tested and it's a starting point for debate rather than a finished program, which is it's refreshing to read that in a book, because quite often when you read books like this, there is a clear blueprint of what the author thinks should happen for definite, whereas you're not saying
that. I think a lot of writers lie awake at night worried that they can't put an idea that isn't absolutely watertight in a book. I think the idea, I think we sometimes lose that ability, that access to people who throw things out and a little bit. And I did sort of struggle. I did shorten the end of the book in the end because I thought I'm trying to answer too many questions here.
Yeah. So the personal democratic budget that you refer to in the book, that's kind of one of your ideas.
Yes.
Do you just want to briefly expand upon that?
Okay. The idea is that you have something equivalent to about £20 a month. I did a back of a fag packet calculation, and I've worked out how much it would cost to run. Imagine somebody came along and said, I'm going to pay for every bit of political activity that's happened in the last year. And I came up with a back of a fag packet figure that said, I think I said 15 billion, the amount of money it would cost to run Parliament, all the MPs' office, all their spads and bag carriers and the sort of the second chamber and the lobby, you know, the pay every lobbyist and pay every journalist who writes and reports on policy issues and pay everybody who participates in political campaigning, that sort of thing. I figured, again, back of a fag packet, we could argue it could be 30 billion, but I you know, my estimate, and I ran it by a few friends, and a few friends said, yeah, 50 million sounds right. Divide that by 60 million, and you come up with a figure not far off £20 a month. So if, essentially, everybody was given a budget funded out of general taxation, where every month they can allocate £20 to paying whoever they want in that microeconomy, hiring people in that microeconomy. In reality, I think what would happen is agencies would grow very quickly that would essentially say, look, we're gonna keep an eye on it. In, you know, in the same way stockbrokers buy and sell shares for you all the time. What we're going to do is we're going to take control of your fund and we're going to spend it in a way that gets... it helps you achieve your objectives. Now tell us what your objectives are. And, you know, you create a market between those brokers. I'm conscious, you know, even listening to myself saying this, that it does sound very far-fetched. And it's almost like a plot from a science fiction novel rather than anything that's likely to happen. But again, the intention, like, you know, like some science fiction, like 1984, which was science fiction, is intended to get people to think through what's wrong, yeah, and understand what's wrong with liberal democracy at the moment. Because, if, you know, the old joke of Mark Twain's that, you know, you should never pick an argument with someone who buys ink by the barrel does apply in politics, doesn't it? That, you know, if I know that that Rupert Murdoch is picking an you know, extreme example, Rupert Murdoch's vote weighs a great deal heavier than mine does. And my vote, because I take a lot of interest, you know, I read newspaper, I read the posh papers sometimes, I read the op-eds and things like that. So my vote probably weighs a great deal heavier than friends of mine who think that politics is a fool's game and don't bother voting. So, no, we all have different amounts of representation, but our capacity to be involved in politics determines the degree to which politics defends our interests, and that's got to be wrong.
I mean, I could sit here and try and pick apart some of the suggestions in your book, but I, in the spirit in which you have written the book, I don't think it's right to try and do that because, like you say, there are more starting points for discussion and debate. One thing that did occur to me, though, about the whole personal democratic budget thing is, I guess, the more I thought about it, the more I started to think of ways in which it could be gamed and that it could actually be... There's a risk that those sorts of systems, because... Like you say, with having like agencies that step in, and because realistically, people aren't going to want to, they won't have the cognitive bandwidth to be able to spend the amount of time that we'd probably all like them to be able to in order to get the most out of this personal democratic budget idea. And therefore, it is going to have to be done on rules of thumb and heuristics and trusting that, you know, trusted agencies will be able to do it in your way. But in your stead, but that is then open to abuse, isn't it? That sort of thing.
I think they'd be buying. I think, you know, people would ultimately be buying brands.
A bit like they do now with political parties. I mean, when people go to the ballot box to vote and they put an X next to the Labour candidate, they probably don't know everything about that Labour candidate. They probably haven't spent weeks and weeks following him or her around and listening to the speeches and understanding in depth what their positions are and everything. They just see Labour, I vote Labour, my dad voted Labour, my granddad voted Labour, X next to Labour. Again, they're using rules of thumb, they're using heuristics, aren't they? It's a trusted brand.
Yes. Yeah, I think that ultimately that's what people will be doing. I think most people will be doing. But the good thing is that someone who really spends ages pouring out, you know, the sort of people that read the form, the racing form in the paper, you know, there's some people going to a bookie and stick a fiver on the nose of a horse that they sound like the name of. And there's someone else who spends ages poring over the odds in the paper and puts an each way bet on a, you know, on a short field. The way I've designed, I've proposed designing democracy, people wouldn't get any benefit from participation. They wouldn't, the policy wouldn't suit them anymore if they spent a lot of time active in politics than someone who spends no time being active at all. So in a way, I think that our current system is very, very gamed at the moment. And I think this system would be, you know, you've actually not given me a way it could be gamed yet.
Yeah, I guess say my thought processes on this are still only partly formed. It was just, I kind of just know how these things tend to work in practice. When you have people one or two or three steps removed from these processes and you have intermediaries in place, that bad actors tend to find ways into the system and will then find ways. So a little bit like the ideas in the book aren't fully formed, my response to it isn't fully formed.
No, quite. I think in a way, I think the thing to really take a step back for a sec, really, I think there's two key things I'm trying to say in the book. The first one is that electoral politics and democracy are not the same thing. That we have, I think most of us have, for most of our lives, treated it as an article of faith that electoral politics is the least worst version of democracy that's available to us at the moment. But I don't think it's exactly the same thing. And it's possible in the future that there'll be systems of running the country that can be more democratic without losing the sort of quality of governance or the justice of it, that there are things that we could do that we might be able to do in the future. So I think we need to break out of just the shackles of just always assuming that politics and democracy are the same thing. They're not. That's the first point. I think the second point is that knowing what we know now about liberal democracy, and about the way it can be abused, about the things that work and the things that don't, because lots of, you know, most things about it work, as I said already, you know, I'm not a detractor of liberal democracy at all. I think if you were to start from scratch, imagine some post-apocalyptic scenario where we were starting from scratch and deciding how we would design democratic government. I think we'd design it differently to the way that electoral politics has designed itself in an evolutionary way over the last 150 years.
You describe it in the book as just a series of benign accidents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's... Did I say accidents? I mean, I think it's...
That might have been my interpretation. That's what I've got in my notes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's an accident, ultimately, that liberal democracies have triumphs economically and even militarily. I think that, you know, I would always bet on a liberal democracy against a kleptocracy in a fair fight. And so I think in a way, you know, distributed intelligence over the last 150 years, remember back in when John Stuart Mill was writing, and, you know, and 60 or 70 years before when Edmund Burke was writing, they had a real problem. They had the Aristotelian problem with democracy. The problem that it would lead to just a government of idiots, that essentially it wouldn't have any of the virtues of good governance, that, you know, democracy would just be a sort of, you know, a government of stupid rabble, and it would collapse in on itself. And when democracy, you know, there were an awful lot of people who were critical of democracy and weren't critical from the reactionary right. Where people are saying, look, I actually really do want people to be in control, but we have to be careful how we design it. And Burke wrote a great deal on representative democracy. De Tocqueville talked about, you know, wrote about representative democracy and about the things that could happen that would irretrievably damage democracy. And I think throughout the 20th century, everyone from Schumpeter, I'm struggling now, Dewey, So many writers, so many political philosophers in the 20th century have recognised that democracy has to be designed fairly carefully. And constitutional reformers have always been conscious that you know, democracy's design is relatively delicate and it could be improved, but it could also be damaged very, very seriously. So I think it's less accidents than representative democracy has helped to solve that problem of quality and justice in emerging democracy. But there's all sorts of things that are now growing up. And because the essence of representative democracy is to some extent, you know, you vote for me and then you kind of leave me alone for 5 years to get on with it. By all means, you know, if you've got if you think there's something I should know, let me know. But ultimately judge me on what happens, you know, next time I come back. And the idea now that people can micromanage politicians, and people do believe they can micromanage politicians, and people are able to interact and are able to damage a politician's reputation if they don't give a speedy and civil and acceptable answer to them. That didn't happen 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, we're also seeing an effect at the moment in the aftermath of the EU referendum, where any members of parliament who are representing a constituency that was majority Leave, and that MP is in favour of like a soft Brexit or even in favour of a second referendum. I'm seeing people saying things like they're not following the will of the people, they're not being democratic, and they need to watch out because they'll be voted out next time. Yes. That seems to completely miss the point of representative democracy, that you elect them to use their judgment rather than just be a delegate for what 50.1% of the people in their constituency might want on an individual issue.
Yes, it's what they talked about in the Labour Party in the 1950s, you know, because Labour isn't going through its first bout of you know, constituency fanatics trying to keep control of the party. In the 1950s, you had people talking about MPs being turned into dictaphones, and the idea that, you know, that constituency parties would just be able to treat politicians as mandated, you know, inflexible people who aren't able to negotiate and people aren't able to be pragmatic or any of those things. The current Labour Party debate does throw into sharp focus what we're talking about here. I think there's a proposal before the Labour Party conference this autumn that is looking at review, you know, it ironically being called the democracy review. And it is about making constituency MPs a great deal more accountable to their constituency parties. And unfortunately, the tragedy is, and I don't think this would have been the case 20 or 30 years ago, there are quite a lot of Labour MPs who are now spineless enough to allow it to happen. And I think there are fewer of them now than then. I don't think certainly left-wing MPs like Barbara Castle would have put up with being treated the way that a lot of Labour MPs are sort of grinning and bearing at the moment.
Or even a more right-wing Labour MP like Dennis Healey, for example. I think people like that wouldn't have put up with this sort of thing.
No, Dennis Healey would, yes. Dennis Healey was a great man. He certainly wouldn't have. Healey was the kind of Titanic who would have taken it on. He would have sailed into battle with it and he would have liked it. He was a very capable politician, I think.
And my grandfather was a great socialist. He always used to say that Dennis Healey was the best prime minister we'd never had. Anyway, that's digressing. We probably need to start wrapping this up in a minute. One of the other ideas in your book, which I know we have talked about before, but I really like the idea of demand revealing referendums. Just because they seem to be so much better structured than just answer yes or no to this one individual question. Do you want to just very briefly outline how they work?
I mean, it's a bit of a nebulous idea, really. It's the idea that, firstly, in consultation, you have to find quick, light ways of getting people to chuck judgments in on things, where people can sort of be quick and light, you know, that you're not getting anything. So you have to choose your subject. You get ideas like participatory budgeting, where people are given the budget for a local area or something like that, and they're given monopoly money, so to speak, and they often spend it very wisely, and often they're able to spend it in ways that are as good and have as good outcomes as when it's done by a small number of eggheads, if you see what I mean. So you are involving people. There are ways of involving people in participative government. A demand revealing referendum is where you're given a bunch of casino chips and a range of subjects and a range of binary questions, and you can put all of your chips on one thing if you really care a lot about it. I mean, a lot of what referendums, a lot of the problems with referendums, it doesn't give any weight. Everybody's vote has the same weight. And the fact is, not everybody particularly cares about an issue that strongly. I was having a conversation earlier today about Ireland in the 1970s, where most people in Ireland were in favour of getting rid of partition and a united Ireland. However, If they were given the choice between the United Ireland and a couple of pence off their phone bill, they would have taken the cut in the phone bill very quickly. It wasn't a salient issue. It was something, you know, do you want Ireland to be a single country? Meh, yeah, why not? But, you know, it wasn't a big issue. Whereas, of course, unionists, a lot of people in the north of Ireland, as we've seen, essentially subordinate all of their other political interests to their conviction that Britain should stay within the union. And as such, I think anything that were to drag unionists out of Northern Ireland would be a huge tyranny of the majority on an issue that people care very strongly about. And so essentially, you know, if you get 51% of the population who have a like preference to do something that 49% of the population would absolutely hate, then you've got a really awful version of democracy. And you could, on a 50% plus one, you could have Scotland leaving the United Kingdom on that. And I think that when you have that attitude to voting, and when Scottish nationalism is geared up to win a referendum by 50% plus one, then I think Scottish nationalists do themselves a real disservice, because they could work a lot harder to come up with a version of devolved government that would have a much wider appeal. But they don't think, you know, the idea is to get the game over the line with this 50% plus one. Rather, to blame
Westminster for all the problems, yes. and you know, divide and conquer.
Yeah. And there is a version of strong devolved government that wouldn't be a total victory for nationalists, but would give them a lot of, and perhaps more than they could hope for, by you know, looking, treating everything as a binary issue. Yeah, you know, the fact is there is a consensus to be built and had around radical decentralisation. If you know, and if it's such a big issue, and it is a big issue for Scottish nationalists, I think it's something that they could have the energy to build a more inclusive argument for, because an awful lot of people that wouldn't like to see the border go and wouldn't like to see separate governments would be happy to see radical decentralisation, would be happy to see decentralisation throughout the UK.
I mean, interestingly, and you reference this in the book, actually, that during the Scottish referendum in 2014, the politicians sort of edged towards a version of what you're talking about there with the whole Devo Max thing that was kind of thrown together at the last minute when Westminster started to panic and thought they might lose the referendum.
Yes.
But it wasn't done in a deliberative fashion with, you know, input from all interested parties over many months or even years. It was just literally cobbled together on the back of a fag packet.
Yeah, the outcome of the Scottish referendum was not one that was on the ballot paper. It was not one that had much of a consensus behind it. It was not one that had been flushed out at all. It was, and what's more, it wasn't even delivered. You know, that a lot of the things that were said in that the pledge a few weeks before the vote, you know, have been quietly swept under the carpet and forgotten about. It's the greatest unhappiness for the greatest number. It's a way of establishing 49.999% of the population, getting them really worked up on an issue they didn't used to care about, and then telling them, get stuffed, you've lost.
In the book, you refer to that as anti-utilitarianism, which I really quite like that. I've not heard that before.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid I made it up. But
well, that's probably why I've not heard it before. I might pass that off as my own in the future, though, Paul. I'll just warn you.
Good man.
Okay, so just to wrap up then, towards the end of the book, something that I found a bit depressing, but is probably true. And I just wonder if maybe we can kind of finish on your thoughts on this. You basically say that the populism that we've seen, this kind of populist spasm, as I think of it, that we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years with Brexit and with the election of Trump. And I mean, there have been other kind of indications of it as well, but they're the two main ones. That I think people like myself and people who perhaps think like me are kind of thinking, hoping that this is just a passing phase, a fad, and it will all be over in a couple of years' time and we can return to normal, in quotes. And you seem to be suggesting that actually this is the new normal and that this populism that we see is permanent. And part of the reason why you've written this book is because we need to adapt our liberal democracy to be able to survive in this new world. Is that a reasonable summation of your thoughts towards the end of the book?
I think so. I certainly don't think the genie is going to get put back in the bottle. I think the genie is the symptom rather than the cause. It's a symptom of a range of things. I mean, micro-targeting is very pernicious, I think. It gets us away from the whole Habermasian idea of a commons, of a deliberative space, when essentially you can give a political party can give exactly opposite messages to two people who live in the same house without either of them knowing. Simply that. Democracy wasn't designed to survive that. You know, generally, if a politician said something, everyone would know they said it, and they wouldn't be able to sort of say two entirely different things to two entirely different audiences. In a way, the craft of politics was people who were very good at doing nearly that. I remember Paddy Ashdown saying that Tony Blair had a real talent for everybody he spoke to, thought that he agreed with them, and actually he didn't. But so I think micro-targeting is here to stay. And I think it'll happen. I think, you know, Facebook may manage to curb it a little bit, but I think that's flying. I think dark money, it's getting a lot easier now to do things that you always had to do above the radar in the past. So astroturfing is possible in a way it never was. I think it's possible to quietly raise money and spend it on outrider supporting issues without attributing them to a political party. So I think that is something that we're going to be constantly locked into a game where people try and raise and spend money on politics out with the spirit of campaign finance rules. And I don't think we're going to be able to change that. I think we're still losing battle. I think that there's the decline of journalism. We're not paying people to do the job that journalists used to do. And even with the media, for all of its failings and all of its ownership biases, always did used to have a large number of people who were, I've spent a lot of my life working with journalists. They're very contentious people. They're very competitive. They will knock each other to bits. And the fact is that there are fewer journalists now who are doing it. And the ones who are doing it on Twitter in that very unsustained way. So I think journalism we're losing that. These were all vital ingredients of the commons. I think the independence of politicians that we talked about earlier was a vital ingredient to representative democracy, and I think that's going to diminish. I think that I could go on. There's a lot of little factors, and the populism we're seeing at the moment, what we're calling populism, I wouldn't personally call it populism, but what people are describing as populism, crude populism, is a symptom of all of those things, and what we're essentially doing is, we're kind of getting the government that will accommodate all of those things, I think it's dangerous. I think we are at a quite a dangerous moment. I wouldn't go over the top. I'm not. I know some people talk about Trump and Brexit almost as though they're two horsemen of the apocalypse. I don't think things are that bad. But I think we can look at the stage that Italy was at in the early 90s when Berlusconi, very similar figure to Trump, incredibly similar. To Trump, in a way, kind of a sort of a foreshadowing of Trump. Italian politics isn't out of that hole. In fact, it's possibly deeper in it now in lots of ways. Now they've got these awful hippies, this Five Star Movement, who the worst sort of right wingers, people who don't think that they're right wing and don't dress like right wingers. But it's a shocking moment that Italy's going through, and it's worse. I think Italy's in a worse state now than it was when it had Berlusconi in charge. And I think, we need to, if you want to see our future, look at Italy. But Italy's a nice place, lovely people. People don't, it's not the end of the world. It's still a civilized place. I don't think we should be painting this as the end of civilization. But certainly politics is going to become less of a contributor to progress than it was.
Okay, that's probably a good point to end the chat on. So thanks very much for your time, Paul. Where can people get hold of the book?
They can get it on Amazon. There are still some copies left. I'm hoping that it's going to be available on Kindle shortly. Yes, or you can buy it directly. It was published by the Democratic Society. A big shout out to them. They're a great organisation. Anthony Zashevsky has been a friend of mine for some years. We met through Democratic Advocacy, and I think DemSoc are really good advocates for looking at ways of introducing a more deliberative and participative public sphere. So they're publishing it on their website. So you can get it from either of those if you don't want to buy things from Amazon.
Okay. So, but if someone, if you Google Save Democracy, Abolish Voting, you should be able to find it somewhere, Amazon or wherever.
Yeah, I mean, I've got on my personal website, there's all the links with all of the kind reviews it's had. It's well, actually, about two or three. It's had two or three reviews. This hasn't been published by a publisher, so it's not by a sort of, you know, a full-time publisher. So it's not had any of the kind of boost. You know, it's my first book. So it's kind of what I was hoping to do.
Yeah, well, as I said to you before we started recording, you know, anyone who's had the wherewithal to write a 140-page book on a subject that they're interested and passionate about, you know, gets a lot of kudos from me, because it's not something I've ever done. Maybe I will at some point, but I've never got myself together to do it so far.
What did you think to the book, Mark? Did you enjoy it?
I did. I thought it was very interesting, and it was very thought-provoking. I agree with your conclusion that things have changed and that we need to do something. I mean, or even probably realistically some things. And some of the things that you suggest, like I mentioned about demand revealing referendum and the whole personal democratic budget thing. I mean, I agree with you as well that I can't see a political path to getting to any of those things anytime soon. But I think the kind of work that this book does and that other people are doing, working up this stuff and the sort of stuff that think tanks do, is very important, because at some point we'll probably get to a point where we think this is really broken now. What are we going to do? And we need to have some, you know, some depth to be able to reach into to think about seriously what can we do. And this sort of work, yeah, I think, is vital for that. So I think it makes a very useful contribution in that respect.
I mean, a lot of when people talk about the problems with democracy, I think they tend to go to either electoral reform.
Guilty. That's me. Yeah. that's my go-to issue. You know,
I would change the voting system. If it was up to me, I would change it. I mean, I think there's the improvements could be made to the voting system. But they go to electoral and constitutional reform on the one hand. But the other thing is that they go to, and there's quite a lot of books, and I've had a few people confusing my book with the Ray Brooks book. I think it's David Ray Brooks, Against Elections, where he advocates sortition. He advocates citizens' juries. And a lot more of that sort of thing. And I'm not completely convinced by that. And I think that really part of the reason I wrote the book was because I would like two or three other people to write books that really offer something other than electoral and constitutional reform or sortition or the sort of really crude liquid democracy or click democracy. I'd really like to see more people really taking the very essence of democracy apart and, you know, studying the political philosophy behind democracy and really understanding what it is. I don't believe that. I think people, when you ask people about what democracy is, if you really corner people and start asking, so what is it really? And once you get beyond, well, it's voting, isn't it? You find that actually a lot of people are scratching their heads. The idea is not a simple, democracy isn't a simple concept to understand. People get very insulted if you say, I don't think you've really thought democracy through properly. But they wouldn't get really insulted if you put another, you know, quite complex, abstract subject in front of them and say, I don't think you've really thought it through, you know. But for some reason, it's very hard to challenge people's grasp of democracy.
I think it's because everyone feels like they own a piece of the democracy that they're in. And if they're challenged, yes, about their understanding of it, it's almost, yeah, seen as a kind of personal insult because, you know, are you, yeah, saying I don't know what I'm voting for? That's kind of how it's interpreted.
I think if I, 9 out of 10 people I'd speak to, if I got into a really detailed conversation about what democracy was, I think we'd have quite a lively argument and quite a disagreement. And it's not, I think there's a sort of, and I think the more people think about it, the more they change. People who've been politicians for a while, once you've been a politician for a while, you've really had to think through what it is. And you have had long, dark nights when you've lain in bed thinking, did I do something that actually wasn't in the public interest, or what the public, you know, what my constituents didn't want? And I think that the longer you're involved in politics a little bit, you do get a deeper grasp of it. And it's not, you know, you get away from the idea that MPs' job is to just do what their voters tell them to do, mandate them to do, and those sorts of things. Those sorts of very crude questions around democracy. You learn that they don't apply. But I think most people would benefit from thinking a lot more about just the theory of democracy.
Well, hopefully this discussion for our listeners, you know, that will help some of our listeners to go and think more deeply about this. Maybe some of them will read the book, and maybe one or two of them might even come up with some of their own ideas and maybe publish them. So fingers crossed. So my thanks to Paul Evans. I will be back with probably a couple more of these special episodes over the next few weeks, and we'll be back properly with more regular episodes after the conference season. I'd like to thank Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music, and this has been a Political Human production.